for the 3rd District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
I may be seated. Good afternoon. Welcome to the 3rd Court of Appeals. My name is Gisella Triana, I'm the senior judge, and along with Justice Shari Kelly and Rosa Theofanis, we'd like to thank you for joining us this afternoon. A couple of housekeeping matters. Are we dividing the time 15:25?
Yes, ma'am.
Normally? Okay. So we are currently being filmed and it's being shown on our YouTube channel. If you'd like to watch afterwards, it'll be there probably later on today. As to the time, we have these wonderful lights up here. If it's green, you're great to go. If it turns yellow, that means you've got 2 minutes left, and then it turns red, it means you're out of time. If you're mid-sentence or mid-thought, please feel free to finish your thought, but wrap it up pretty quickly after that. I'm thinking that's going to be it. At this time, I am going to call cause number 325240CV. William Corioth, WTK Development LLC, Kona Coast LLC, Guadalupe 306 GP LLC, Kona Coast Venture LTD, Oxbow Land Partners LLC, Hideout on the Horseshoe LLC, and Whitewater Sports LLC versus Whitewater Investment Partners LLC for itself and derivatively on behalf of Oxbow Land Partners LLC, Hideout on the Horseshoe LLC, Whitewater Sports LLC, and Kona Coast Venture LTD, Andrew J. Priest and Priest Equities LLC. If I can please have both sides make your announcement and let me know who you're representing.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Matthew Baumgartner on behalf of appellants, and joined at council table by my partner, Guillermo Alarcón.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Byron Keenan. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellate.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Baumgartner, if you'd like to proceed.
May it please the court. The trial court's injunction must be dissolved in full. Appellants present several grounds for reversal, including the injunction's failure on its face to meet Rule 683's mandatory requirements, the failure to meet the heightened standards for anti-suit injunctions, which should be reserved for only very special circumstances, and the required elements of a temporary injunction. I would like to focus on the issue that is fully dispositive, presents a pure question of law, and on which this court's review is de novo, and that is the required element of a probable right to recovery or relief. The issues there are neither novel, nor controversial, nor difficult. To meet its burden for a temporary injunction, the plaintiff below, I'll call WIP, was required to show a probable right to recovery on the merits of at least one of its pleaded causes of action. That's always been part of the requirements for a temporary injunction. Within that element, in this case, the probable right to recovery or relief, this is a shareholder dispute. So often, in such cases, the very first question is, what does the shareholder agreement provide? What does it say? How does it allocate the rights and duties that are at issue? For many decades, Texas courts have been required to enforce the terms of partnership agreements that the parties, through their counsel, negotiate with each other. That then kind of becomes the binding set of rules that they operate under. That's what happened here. This court has recently affirmed very similar provisions. The Dunster case comes to mind as one that we have here that would be entirely dispositive of the probable right to relief element. Now, why do I say that? At the time of the temporary injunction hearing, WIP had pleaded only causes of action based on an alleged breach of that shareholder agreement that is utterly implausible. It's foreclosed entirely by the plain language of the contract plus all the evidence, but one need not get there. And that's that Corioth did not let WIP into his independent real estate project. And that's what all of their causes of action that had been pleaded at the time of this temporary injunction said. They overpleaded it dramatically, but they all related to that. Separately from that, there was a pleading in Travis County that appellants here filed relating to a different set of facts and a different set of circumstances arising from WIP's music venue breach, what the contract actually prohibits. Those causes of action in Travis County were pleaded there because that's where they occurred, that's where all the witnesses are, and that, of course, is what the agreement actually said.
Counsel, do you also plan to address the Rule 683 argument in your remarks?
Certainly can. I think the briefing on that was extensive. If the court has any questions directed to 683, I'd be happy to answer.
We could decide the case on that basis as well, right?
You could, Your Honor. I think 683 is dispositive. You would have to go, I think, paragraph by paragraph to apply 683's requirements. I think each paragraph is woefully deficient under the specificity requirements and the requirement for explaining its rationale. However, I think one risk in stopping there is that, particularly if it's a form-based ruling, I think what's going to happen is the trial court is going to rewrite the injunction. You would still be left with a fundamentally defective injunction, because in every injunction, the required element, one of the required elements is a probable right to relief. And if that fails, the whole injunction fails. That's settled law. And if that element presents a question of law, then that is the easiest, clearest basis for reversal. Courts interpret contracts every day. That's job number one for the court. It should have been the starting point for the trial court here, but for a long time now, the trial court has sort of set the agreement's plain terms aside, and really as a result, the case has just become completely unmoored from any guiding principles, really.
But then we've got a different burden in looking at that, right? I mean, if they can point to some evidence in the record, haven't they met their burden for us affirming the TI versus a 683 argument, which is analyzed differently?
I don't think so in this particular case, because if you looked at just the pleaded causes of action in Kamal County, that does really present a pure question of law. It starts and certainly can stop with the plain language of the shareholder agreement. So what was at issue at the time of this TI hearing was pleadings presented by WIP that, even despite the very clear language of this agreement that allows all the partners to conduct anything other than music venues independently and has multiple provisions for changing that agreement, must be done in writing, shareholder vote, et cetera. All of that really forecloses the underlying claims that were pleaded in the Kamal County Court. There was no possible plausible construction of the contract that could support a probable right to relief. So your burden there is de novo. That is a pure de novo review. You don't have to reach the evidence. We briefed it. It's all uncontroverted. The partners time and again for years said this contract remains too true, correct, and complete. And of course, the other side did at least 10 that we know of. We've had trouble getting discovery, but at least 10 that we know of other independent real estate deals. So it's not even the right kind of case for changing a contract by conduct or implicitly. But you can stop on the pure question of law on probable right to relief, because that's what they had pleaded. And that was by choice. That was by litigation strategy choice by them. They knew there were pleadings on file in Travis County relating to music venues. And that, Justice Kelly, is where they say, I think this is where their only attempt to say there are competing fact issues. There's some evidence in the record. That's on the music venue breach, which was only pleaded in Travis County. They say, although it's meritless, geez, I didn't know they were really music venues. Well, of course you did. Multiple emails showing that you did. The seller, the manager all testified that there were music venues. Kendrick Lamar and Cage the Elephant played there. There was a video of it.
And crowd-surfed, right? Didn't somebody crowd-surf? I read that.
That was, I tried to find a way to put that video in the brief, but I hopefully you found it. But that claim, which wasn't pleaded in Kamal County, only in Travis County that they, you know, admittedly tried to stop having to go to, or prevent themselves from having to go to Travis County. They wanted to stay very much in Kamal County, which is why they sought an anti-suit injunction. The music venue dispute and those facts, if they are conflicting or competing, which they're not, those are only in Travis County. They weren't here. And so on what's before the court is what was pleaded.
They were here.
Sorry, yes, they were. Thank you. They were here in Austin. They weren't here in this case in Kamal County. Thank you. And so that's the fundamental problem, is that you have to look at what the pleaded causes of action are at the time of the injunction and whether there is any probable right to relief there. And, you know, it's been true for ages that in shareholder disputes, you start that analysis by looking at the shareholder agreement. Now, there was some argument in the brief by WIP that you really can't do that. They're trying to get an advanced ruling on the merits. That's not so. You know, the Supreme Court has dispelled a line of kind of wayward cases that said, you know, that would be an advisory opinion if you reached the merits. We're not asking the court to reach the merits. What we're asking the court to do is address the probable right to relief and rule that it's determined by the unambiguous language of a very clear contract that leaves no room for its claims that it pleaded below. Bianati said that in 2024. Abbott versus ADL actually reached the probable right to relief element based on a pure question of law, even before reaching a standing question, because it was the easier question. Abbott versus Harris County did the same thing. In Re State, even WIPS cases do that. Sonwalker is one where this element turned on the court's de novo review of the contract. East Texas Kidney Associates was a recent case from 2024, and Kazar Motors was one we cite in the brief, same thing, that reversed a temporary injunction on this element because it was fully dispositive and determined by a question of law that was de novo review. So I actually think it's easier to do the de novo review on that element, probable right to relief, based on the plain reading of the contract or the partnership agreement. You really don't have to reach anything else beyond that because it's fully dispositive.
The case in Kamal County was filed prior to the case in Travis County, correct?
That's true.
Could the case or the issues in the case in Travis County be litigated in Kamal County?
I think they could. I think there were permissive counterclaims. Okay. But I think the distinction for anti-suit injunction purposes is they weren't compulsory because they obviously arose out of different sets of facts and different time and different witnesses and everything.
Are there any issues? I guess the concern for the judiciary, of course, is that you have two different cases in two different counties at the same time that might end up in conflicting rulings.
Yes.
So is that a possibility?
It could theoretically be a possibility that there's, say, for example, a removal, a favorable judgment to Corioth on Priest's breach from the music venue activity in the Austin Court of Appeals. But I don't think there would be necessarily a conflicting judgment, but a jury could find, I don't think it would be supported by any evidence, but the jury, you know, in theory, just speaking theoretically, hypothetically, could say there was no, if we asserted those facts in Kamal County as a prior breach that, you know, negated any subsequent breach related to real estate. But here's why I don't think that's really...
Well, but I mean, both suits are trying to get the opposing party out of the partnership, right?
Yes, although the removal claims in Kamal County are frankly just merit.
regardless of your thoughts on the merits.
Yeah.
Theoretically, you could have a court in Comal County that tells your client you're removed, and you could have a Travis County court telling his client he's removed. Is that correct?
In theory, it could end up that way. But what's important for anti-suit injunction purposes is, and the courts are very clear, that the possibility of conflicting judgments. You can't enjoin another court to avoid the possibility of conflicting decisions or to discourage duplicative litigation. That's been very clear in the courts. And so the way to deal with that problem, and the reason why the court's anti-suit injunction was wrong here, the way to deal with that possibility, and this stems from comedy and a lot of other concerns, is you go to the second filed suit and ask for a plea and abatement. That's the required procedure. You don't go to the first filed suit and say, enjoin that other court from doing anything. And that's one of the reasons. That certainly requires reversal of the anti-suit injunction provision here. And, you know, in the record, we made this argument to the trial court. The trial court was confused about whether it was even granting an anti-suit injunction about Travis County. After some extensive argument, it decided that it was, initially said it wasn't. And you know, we said that's improper. They need to go file a plea and abatement in Travis County. And they said on the record, well, we're trying to avoid having to do that. That's why we want you to just enjoin that other court. And she said, okay, that's improper. That you only enjoin other courts if those other courts are doing something extraordinary. I mean, courts say that's got to be based on unique circumstances. One of WIP's cases, Encore out of El Paso, and that arose out of a situation where a Dallas court was literally telling the parties not to follow orders from the El Paso court. We don't have anything like that here. We have a theoretical possibility of conflicting judgments, but certainly they don't meet the mandatory or compulsory counterclaims test because they don't arise out of the same transactions, circumstances. The two sets of facts are just not logically connected.
One detail to ask, assuming that we did decide to look at the 683, so this subsection C talks about a duty to inform plaintiffs within 30 days.
Yes.
Is that provision moot?
No, it's not at all moot. In fact, there's not at all. They haven't disavowed it. The trial court hasn't removed it from the injunction. There's still a pending motion to enforce it. They told the court in their brief that they had removed the request for sanctions related to that provision. 3 days later, filed a motion where they seek sanctions. It's not moot at all.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Mr. Keeling.
May it please the court. The appellant spent a lot of time in their briefs and even here today arguing the merits of summary judgment motions that they lost in the trial court and that they unsuccessfully tried to permissively appeal. This is a TI appeal. By longstanding tradition, a temporary injunction is not a ruling on the merits. The very purpose of a temporary injunction is to preserve the status quo pending a trial on the merits. The appellants rely on the Texas Supreme Court opinion in Binotti to argue that the merits can't be altogether ignored, and that's true. But the court in Binotti went on to say at headnotes 15 to 17 that it still wasn't changing the fact that a temporary injunction is not a ruling on the merits. The question on a TI appeal is never whether the applicant will win on the merits. It's just a question of whether the applicant is entitled to preserve the status quo. And this is a classic case for a temporary injunction. While this case was pending, and after each side had sued the other claiming a material breach of the partnership agreement, Mr. Korioth engaged in self-help to declare unilaterally that WIP was no longer a partner and no longer entitled to any of the benefits of the partnership. And not surprisingly, WIP asked for a temporary injunction to leave it in place as a partner and to preserve the status quo, to not eliminate the very subject matter of the dispute before the merits could be resolved. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in granting WIP's requested injunction. And at the outset, I have to quibble with the idea that any part of this analysis is de novo. It's not. Even the cases that Mr. Korioth relies on say over and over and over again, this is a matter of an abuse of discretion, and it's subject to the usual standard of review for an abuse of discretion, including the fact that this court won't substitute its own judgment for that of the trial court.
But so I'm going to go. Let's talk about the part of the injunction that prevents a Travis County court from going forward with their own case. Why didn't y'all just ask for an abatement in Travis County?
Well, it's absolutely true. We could have asked for an abatement in Travis County. But as the court in El Paso noted in the Encore case, we did not have to. There is another way to do it. And the Texas Supreme Court in the Gibbons case recognized back in the 1970s, in a case that's still good law, that a Texas court may restrain another party from pursuing an action in a Texas court that creates parallel lawsuits that waste judicial resources. The real question for purposes of whether an anti-suit injunction is proper is this. Did the court that issued the injunction have dominant jurisdiction? And here, unquestionably, the court in Comal County had dominant jurisdiction. A first-file court has dominant jurisdiction not only over the claims in that court, but also over any compulsory counterclaims. From the beginning, WIP sued on a breach of contract claim for breach of the partnership agreement. As early as 2022, Mr. Korioth had filed a counterclaim arguing, no, Mr. Priest and Priest Equities breached that partnership agreement first. They were the parties that created the first material breach. That's the same argument that they are making in Travis County. And in cases like Compass and in cases like Encore, courts have recognized that competing claims of first material breach properly belong in one court rather than two.
So can I ask you a question? Did the trial court hold that the suit in Travis County cannot continue, but that there's a Hays County lawsuit that can continue?
That's correct. The Hays County lawsuit, everyone acknowledges, has nothing to do with the Comal County lawsuit. The Hays lawsuit arises out of a redemption agreement that's not an issue in Comal County.
So turning back then to the language of the injunction, where can we find that? How can we look at the injunction and see that, you know, distinction?
The injunction says on its face that the parties may not pursue the same claims in another court in Texas. And that's exactly what the Travis County case is. I mean, on its face, in Comal County, Korioth is suing on a breach of the partnership agreement and is seeking declaratory relief to remove WIP as a partner. In Travis County, Mr. Korioth is suing for a breach of the partnership agreement, asking for declaratory relief to remove WIP as a partner. The claims are identical. They may involve different facts, but that doesn't change the nature of the claim. And let's put it in this context. Let's put it in the Encore context. If the parties were allowed to put on all of their evidence of first material breach in both lawsuits, then by definition, you have a waste of judicial resources.
But in looking at B, you said, okay, they can't bring the same lawsuits. But the order doesn't say same. It says same or similar claims. So how are they to know what is encompassed within similar claims to comply with Rule 683?
Well, first of all, there's no quibbling with the word same. The parties know what that is, and they understood that. They asked for clarification on the record, and they got clarification on the record that the injunction does apply to the Travis County lawsuit.
But the oral, can we look to, you know, the oral explanation of what the judge thinks this means when we're evaluating under 683, or are we bound by what the judge put in their order?
Well, I think absolutely. This court can look to a clarification that was made on the record when the parties explicitly asked for it. And they asked for confirmation that it applied to Travis County. The court confirmed it does apply to the Travis County lawsuit. And again, from my perspective, I don't really have any problem with the word same or similar claims, even under Rule 683. Reasonable lawyers understand what same or similar is. This court and other courts across Texas have applied to those words routinely under the law to determine whether claims are subject to preclusive effect or whether claims really qualify as compulsory counterclaim. Those words are not difficult, and reasonable lawyers would understand them. And with that, I apologize to some extent for jumping back and forth, but let me go back to the Rule 683 issue because I think that's fairly important. The appellants try to parse particular words, words like similar, and suggest that those words in a vacuum are overly broad. Two things about that. First of all, the court in Livingston cautioned against that kind of approach and pointed out that an injunction has to be broad enough by definition to ensure that a party can't sidestep it and continue to engage in the conduct that's offensive in the first place. But the second thing about that is this court has recognized in Koenig, the 14th District recognized within the last month in Musa. This court has the authority, if it wishes, to modify the injunction and excise, if necessary, any language that it finds to be overly broad and still preserve the remainder. So in that light, paragraph A is pretty clear on its face. It bluntly says, don't remove WIP as a partner while the case is pending. Leave WIP as a partner for the duration of this case. Mr. Corioth himself testified at the TI hearing. He knows what it means to treat WIP as a partner. As the controlling person for the general partner, Mr. Corioth has been doing exactly that for 11 years. He knows how to distribute revenues. He knows what issues require supermajority consent. This is not complicated.
So in response to their argument about purporting to remove, one solution would be just striking that we strike purporting to remove from that.
You could, but again, I don't really have any trouble with that language, and here's why.
I imagine you don't have trouble with any of the language in the order, right?
You know, I'm pretty reasonable that way. But this came about because of a removal letter, a letter in February 2024 that Mr. Corioth's lawyers say is effective immediately. They say it immediately has the effect of removing WIP. And our response to that is to say, well, wait a second. If you previously materially breached the contract, then you don't have the authority to remove us effective immediately. At best, you're just purporting to remove us. And that's what the language means. Everyone understands that. Don't say WIP is removed. Don't even pretend WIP is removed. Don't purport to remove WIP through further removal letters. That's all it means. And I think everyone really understood that. To come after the fact and try to broaden the depth of the word purporting is to make up arguments that really don't exist when everyone understands what it means not to remove WIP as a partner. And significantly, the appellants largely ignore this court's opinion in Universal Health. They rely on this court's opinion in Winston, but in footnote 4 in Winston.
A very well-reasoned opinion, you would agree.
Oh, yeah. But also in footnote 4, the court reinforced the fact that universal health is still good law.
We contrasted it to the case at hand, but we didn't overrule it.
That is fair enough. And you're going to point out very quickly that I like universal health, and I do. The reason I like universal health is that this court recognized on the face of universal health, look, the trial court reasonably could conclude in that case that because the parties had been running a hospital for 3 years, the trial court didn't have to specify everything that needed to be done in running a hospital to preserve the status quo. Here.
Right, but since then we have cases like Luther from the Supreme Court that say in-person services at a hair salon is not specific enough for a TI.
And under the facts of that case, that made sense. There were lots of individual items of evidence that made it clear that in that case, the parties really couldn't understand from that language what their duties and obligations are. This court has since confirmed, even after Winstone and Coney, that ultimately it comes down to a question of whether the party who's restrained can, from his own knowledge of the context, understand his duties and obligations.
So in this case, the TI binds all defendants, and you've spoken about Corioth's knowledge of what it would mean to remove or purport to remove. Is his knowledge to be imputed to all defendants?
No, his knowledge is certainly imputed to the defendants who are subject to the injunction. He's the controlling party for WTK. He operates the general partner. Those really are the parties that are being restrained under the injunction. No one else really has any control over the removal of WIP. Regardless. As to paragraph B, we've talked a little bit already about the words same or similar. I want to interject this comment as well. No Rule 683 objection was properly preserved with respect to paragraph B in the first instance. This court in DHBJ, I'm not going to get those initials correct, but this court has continued to recognize that a party must properly preserve a Rule 683 objection in the trial court, and there's a good reason for that. The trial court has to have a reasonable opportunity to be able to cure any Rule 683 objection. Each side points to the same argument in the record. It's at volume 8, pages 139 through 40. And you can see there that Mr. Corioth's counsel made three objections to the form of the injunction. The first one's not an issue. It hadn't been raised in this appeal. The third one is the objection to the anti-suit injunction component of this appeal. And the second objection was a Rule 683 objection that was tailored specifically to paragraph A. Nowhere on pages 139 or 40 does counsel in any way argue that paragraph B is defective, nor does counsel give the trial court a reasonable opportunity to cure any Rule 683 objection to paragraph B. This court has continued to recognize in cases like Polston versus State in 2022 that Rule 683 objections need to be preserved. I acknowledge that other courts have held differently. This court has acknowledged that as well, but it's still the rule in this court. Now, as for the probable right to relief, the Texas Supreme Court in Bonatti said that a probable right to relief is just that, probable, not definitive. And the standard is merely whether there was some evidence. It is good, right, and appropriate for a trial court to conclude in cases where there is competing evidence that a jury is the right party to determine the outcome of the issue on the merits. And it is good, right, and appropriate for a trial court to conclude that in the meantime, the parties should be restrained from interfering with the very subject matter of the lawsuit and defeating what the parties are arguing about until there is a trial on the merits. At the 4-day temporary injunction hearing, the issue that was litigated at length in front of the trial court was simply who first breached the partnership agreement by investing in a music venue. And significantly, in that four-day hearing, much evidence was offered without any objection on that issue going both ways. The issue was tried at length by consent. When Mr. Corioth first raised the issue in the trial court, Mr. Corioth relied very heavily on City of Austin permits that allowed the Monkey and Rooster to conduct business as music venues. Those same Austin City permits, which are also in evidence, allow the Hangar Lounge to conduct business as a music venue. And Mr. Corioth's investment in the Hangar Lounge long preceded Mr. Priest or Priest Equity's investment in the Monkey and Rooster. And, you know, that's ultimately what the trial court was faced with, competing evidence as to who first invested in a music venue. You've heard counsel suggest, and counsel argued in the trial court in Comal County, well, our evidence is better. Our evidence is more persuasive. That's not the test. The test is simply whether there's some evidence. And what Whip's counsel offered to the Comal County Court was exactly the same type and quality of evidence that Mr. Corioth himself offered. Just as there's videos, social media accounts, and photographs of bands and DJs playing in the Rooster and the Monkey, there are social media accounts and photographs of bands and DJs playing at the Hangar Lounge. The trial court rightly said, look, there's evidence going both ways. I think this is a jury issue. The jury ought to decide it. And that's enough for a probable right to relief. Lastly, on the issue of irreparable harm, courts in cases like Sunwalker and Chenier Energy have recognized that the loss of management rights under a corporate agreement or a partnership agreement is sufficient to establish irreparable injury or harm. That's the case here. The trial court expressly found in its injunction that Corioth's attempt to remove WIP as a partner potentially raised the threat that WIP would lose its supermajority rights, and that's sufficient for irreparable harm. Two last points responsive to opposing counsel's comments. Opposing counsel referenced this court's opinion in Dunster. Dunster's a case involving a specific contract that said there's no obligation on the parties at all not to compete. All parties may compete. That's not the case here. We have specific language in Section 13.18 that's at issue that says the parties can't compete in certain circumstances. That's the very subject of the lawsuit yet to be litigated. Opposing counsel also refers to Kedzar Motors out of Tyler. Yeah, that's a case where the court denied injunctive relief and said, look, under the abuse of discretion, not de novo, standard of review, we've got to defer to the trial court's findings. And we deferred to the trial court's findings that there was insufficient grounds to grant injunctive relief. Not the case here. Thank you. Whip respectfully asks that this court affirm the trial court's temporary injunction order.
The issue of the Hangar Lounge, all that conflicting evidence, that was not conflicting evidence that related to any cause of action that was pleaded in Comal County at the time of the injunction hearing. None whatsoever. If they had gotten a temporary injunction from a Travis County district court, maybe they have a credible argument. But you can't just go into court and say injunction without establishing a cause of action and probable right to relief. So all of that discussion is for a different kind of case that they don't have here. Second, it fails on its face. It's no evidence. Even if you do reach the merits of this issue, which you shouldn't, because again, that's for the Travis County Court, The Hangar Lounge, and this is an important clarification that their brief really misled the court on at page 73. They say that Corioth admitted acquiring that investment in 2014, the same year as the contract, the partnership agreement. He didn't. He acquired it in 2009 by giving his brother a small loan or investment to help get the cocktail lounge established. 2009. So their argument is a 2009 investment violated a 2014 corporate opportunity provision. That's no evidence, Your Honors.
What's your response to the preservation argument as to B of the injunction?
I think it's preserved. I mean, we, you know.
I presume you would argue that, but why?
Right, because we did argue that the injunction fails to meet all requirements on its face under Rule 683. We started out making a broad objection to the whole thing, and then we went in, we got into an extensive argument on the anti-suit injunction standards, right? But that doesn't mean that we're not also arguing 683B. I mean, we had an extensive argument about what does similar even mean. In that discussion, the trial court said, I don't think this means the Travis County litigation. What do you think, Mr. Hall? And Mr. Hall said, well, actually, that was kind of the whole point. And the trial court then said, oh, okay. And then I said,
well, the
okay,
trial court said this doesn't apply to anything in the past, right?
Which included Travis County. Yeah. So we argued that extensively. Did we say we object to the word similar as not specific enough under Rule 683? No, we did not say that. Is that required? No, it is not. There were pages and pages of argument about that. And also, context there, we got no notice. You know, you're entitled to notice on a temporary injunction. What's happened repeatedly in this case is that we end up arguing motions, including the temporary injunction, on no notice of what they actually want to argue. And that's just been an abusive process in this case throughout for the past 5 years. And we were actually told no argument. And we had to kind of press the court to make our objections on the record. But I think we did fairly preserve that through several pages of argument that the Travis County case was not the same or similar. I think I heard counsel say paragraph A is clear on its face. Paragraph A refers to rights, titles, privileges, ownership. That is not specific enough. In this case, they say all of those things, rights, titles, ownership, means things that aren't even written down in the contract, aren't even written down in the agreement. And they only put one agreement that provision even relates to into evidence. There's three other ones they didn't put into evidence. And they say those rights, titles, ownership means not just music venues as written, but some kind of real estate duties that they have flailed for years to say what that means. I mean, even in this brief, they're saying, well, the expanded definition, the automatically expanding definition of business, that means we know we pleaded for commercial real estate. We know we pleaded that for 4 years, but now we're retracting that. Only residential real estate. Why did they say that? It's a game of whack-a-mole. Because we pointed out that Mr. Priest has done multiple commercial real estate investments. And that sort of brings me back to the de novo point. The court's review of the company agreement is, of course, de novo. Abbott versus Harris County says that. That's in the brief. State versus Southwestern Bell says that's a de novo review. That's a 1975 case. There's nothing new here. East Texas Kidney Associates. Counsel said, don't look at Kazar. That was affirming the denial of injunction. East Texas Kidney Associates denied an injunction at the trial court, reversed on appeal, based on plain language, de novo review of a shareholder agreement. So the court absolutely can do that. And that's the easiest question before this court. It's fully dispositive. And all it takes is reviewing the contract, which, frankly, everybody could benefit from. They say don't do it because it's a merits question. No, it's a probable right to relief question. It might have ancillary implications for the merits. But 5 years later, a bankruptcy later, a foreclosure, a second company about to be disintegrated by this litigation, frankly, wouldn't be a bad thing. We ask that the court dissolve the injunction in full. Thank you.
Thank you. This time, cause number 325240CV is submitted. Court's going to stand in recess, and we will be back at 2:30 to proceed with our second case.
Call please rise.